Hi, it's Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley and from around the state, coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Zoe Rome, and I'm here with Wyatt Orm. Hi, Wyatt.
Hi, Zoe.
So Aspen, Snowmass, and Sunlight Ski Resorts are all open after early season snow and cold weather. Aspen Highlands opens this weekend.
We'll take a look at what early snow means for skiers and rivers alike.
With ski season means tourism, and it turns out that nearly a quarter of the valley's rentals are rent by owner.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition. The transient occupancy study in Aspen and Snowmass is a count of how many beds are on the market for visitors. This year's data show a 33% increase in the number of beds that are now available directly from the owner on sites like Airbnb and HomeAway. Allison Bektesh spoke with Bill Tomsich, who has overseen the study for the last 12 years.
What part of this study was most interesting to you?
All of the nuances and the changes that took place within the bed base. If you go way back in time, back when I first came to town in 1995, we were flush with beds. There were a lot of small lodges that ended up going by the wayside. And I had actually attempted to track what was happening with our bed base myself. So then I realized that this information is of great value, not only to Aspen Skiing Company, because it basically speaks to the theoretical capacity of our resort, you know, how many pillows there are for Aspen Skiing Company's lift tickets to sleep. So those numbers deteriorated significantly from about 1995, my first couple of years at the helm of Aspen Central Reservations, through 98, 99, 2000.
Okay.
We just saw this wave of properties going out of business. A lot of properties got bulldozed and replaced by luxury townhomes.
Okay.
So we saw an erosion of thousands of pillows. You know, at one point in time, I had calculated almost 10,000 pillows in the city of Aspen alone, and that quickly went down to, you know, fewer than 8,000 pillows over a period of about 5 to 7 years.
Who else do you think will keep a pretty close eye on this study, and what do you think they'll be using that data for?
Certainly the city, because we believe there's tax dollars that are being left on the table that could be used for marketing and the general fund as well. Others who may be interested are other property management companies, because they're competing against the RBO channels, and you know they potentially could be at a competitive disadvantage if a paying guest finds a less expensive home on an RBO channel, and if one of the reasons it's less expensive is because they're not paying their fair share of taxes. There's no question that exists. The challenge is managing it and then monitoring it.
Bill, thank you so much for your time.
Anytime.
That was Bill Tomsich giving insight into newly released data showing the number of available beds for visitors in the Roaring Fork Valley.
Occupancy in Aspen is up thanks to early winter snow. This November's visitor numbers are projected to be slightly ahead of last year, up about 4%. This year, the resort opened a week early with more snow, terrain, and lifts for early season skiers. And it's all about the snow, according to Aspen Skiing Company's Jeff Hanley. There are, however, some headwinds in foreign markets. Brazil and Argentina are typically bigger players, but economic instability has slowed visits from those countries. A strong U.S. dollar might also push foreign customers to Canada or Japan, where there's a more favorable exchange rate. SkiCo is hoping to nab more visitors with cheap lift tickets ahead of the busy holiday season.
Early season snowfall in some parts of the Colorado River Basin has raised hopes for a drought recovery. Luke Runyon reports that optimism might be premature.
Most western streams and rivers are fed by melting Rocky Mountain snow. Last winter's record heat and dryness left large portions of the Southwest in deep drought. Reservoirs plummeted, streams dried up, and unable to feed their cattle, ranchers sold off their herds. Now, with snow returning to the Rockies, water policy analyst John Berggren says it's tempting to ask if the drought might be finished. He's with the environmental group Western Resource Advocates.
The tricky thing with drought in the West and with water supplies in the West more broadly is it's a much more long-term, slow process both to get into a drought and to get out of a drought.
So it's way too soon to say it's over. Berggren says it's also difficult to say whether a particular dry period is a short-lived drought or a sign of climate change, making the region more arid. I'm Luke Runyon.
Snowmass Ski Resort opened last week, and the new Base Village is banking on free attractions to pull families in this winter. The new Snowmass Base Village is a $600 million project set to open on December 15th. While it includes luxury amenities like an exclusive ski club, yoga studio, and residences, the base's centerpiece is this pedestrian mall and community center. The community center is a multi-purpose building with dining, a flexible event space, a new Mastodon discovery area, and kids' game room. An ice skating rink sits between the community center and the new Limelight Hotel. For its first year, the rink will offer free skating and skate rentals as well as s'mores, costing an estimated $200,000, paid for by the Snowmass Base Village Masters Association.
This is a group of property owners in Snowmass Base Village formed to promote the area as a year-round family destination. The Limelight Hotel is offering a five-story climbing wall for village visitors. The wall's topography is based on popular outdoor climbing routes from around the Roaring Fork Valley. The climbing wall and Limelight Hotel open December 14th, one day ahead of Snowmass Base Village.
A new exhibit at the Aspen Art Museum blends sculpture and performance and engages its audience outside of the museum. A display case containing a polished aluminum megaphone sits on the sidewalk. Every day at noon, a man takes out the megaphone and shouts, "It's never too late to say sorry." Kristen Kay attended the first performance and found that the piece is garnering applause and evoking thought.
It's noon in Aspen. A crowd of about 30 that's gathered outside the Aspen Art Museum stops chatting about ski passes and what they'll get for lunch. More than a few people train their phones on a silver megaphone that's glinting in the sun. A middle-aged man emerges from the crowd and unlocks the case. He holds the megaphone to his mouth and...
"It's never too late to say sorry!"
The crowd breaks into applause. It's Never Too Late to Say Sorry is by Danish artist Michael Elmgreen and Norwegian artist Ingar Dragset. They specified that the performer must be a middle-aged man. Today, it's a security guard from the art museum. Elmgreen and Dragset are perhaps best known for creating Prada Marfa. It's an installation that looks like a Prada store in the middle of the desert outside of Marfa, Texas. The pair's work often plays with how art is exhibited and experienced. Aspen Art Museum Executive Director Heidi Zuckerman says she was drawn to the piece because it challenges traditional notions of an art museum experience.
A lot of times people think of a museum and they think of it filled with dusty paintings that you go and stand in front of one after the other in a very specified and linear experience.
Zuckerman says the museum is fortunate to be able to put artwork outside. That way, she says, there are no barriers between art and audience, not even a door. She says they use the space for provocative pieces.
We try and put work there that sparks a conversation.
Zuckerman says the piece might be an antidote to a culture that's becoming more contentious.
Being able to remind people that you can still, you know, make amends, I think is a good message, not just for our community, but for the global community.
Outside the art museum, Dan Fordham says it's never too late to say sorry didn't make him think of who he should apologize to so much as what he would yell into a bullhorn on a street corner.
It's different things, but the most recent one I was just thinking about was don't waste your money on lottery tickets.
Zuckerman says the timing of the opening of the piece is meant to give Aspenites a bit of a jolt of energy in the quiet of the off-season. And Fordham seems to have felt it.
I loved it. Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought the whole performance was fun.
Joelle McDonough is still smiling minutes after the bullhorn has been placed back in its case.
I think it's fun. I just think it's great they're going to do this every day. It will bring a lot of people.
It's Never Too Late to Say Sorry will bring art to the street and perhaps surprise some unsuspecting passersby through May of 2019. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
The Arts and Culture Desk at Aspen Public Radio is funded by the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orme.
And I'm Zoe Rome. Wyatt, dedicated Aspen Public Radio listeners are engaged with what's going on in their communities, and that's why they tune in to all of our programming, including Mountain Edition, where we take them back over what happened this past week.
That's right. Mountain Edition is one of many ways listeners can stay up to date. They can also go to our Facebook page, and while you're there, don't hesitate to like it. We also have a Twitter account for all the voracious social media consumers out there listening. Our handle is @AspenPubRadio.
And check out our newest show, Airtime. It's extended conversations with interesting people. This week, a look at the mark that Hunter S. Thompson left on journalism and journalist Jose Antonio Vargas' perspective as an undocumented citizen reporting in the U.S.
You can find Airtime and all of our programming online at aspenpublicradio.org.
This week, guests can stay at the newly renovated Redstone Castle. It's now a boutique hotel and events center. Following 2 years of renovation, arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay toured the property with the new owners, and she joins me now in the studio. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Zoe.
So what is the new and improved Redstone Castle like?
Well, the goal is really to make it feel like the old or original Redstone Castle. So there are 66 rooms. Many of them appear exactly as they might have when John D. Rockefeller or Teddy Roosevelt stayed there. There are the original Tiffany lamps, some original furniture even. The castle was fairly run down before this renovation, so for things that needed to be replaced or repaired, a lot was done to make sure that the original materials were matched as closely as possible. So, for example, artists were hired to hand paint pieces of wallpaper that were damaged. You can also see the original living quarters for the owners and guests of the castle and their servants. The servants had separate entrances, separate shared spaces, so it feels a little bit Downton Abbey.
But it's a hotel now.
Yes, the new owners, Steve and April Carver, own the Hotel Colorado in Glenwood Springs, so they're fairly experienced with this combination of hospitality and history. The Carvers were committed to respecting the property, to renovating it really faithfully, so it did appear much like the original Redstone Castle. But April Carver said they feel like it should be shared with other people. So here's Carver.
This property needs to be used by the public. It needs people in it. It needs life in it. If it's too many years, it didn't have enough life.
When the Carvers were working with Pitkin County to get this zoned for events and hotel guests, they argued that the only way to really maintain the castle in all its glory in the long term was to have it generate some income through these small-scale events and this boutique hotel idea, which has just 11 rooms right now.
So let's take a step back. Can you remind us of the history of the castle that the Carvers are trying to preserve here?
Yeah, this castle is about 115 years old. This coal and steel magnate, John Cleveland Osgood, built it. He invited wealthy, powerful people at the time to stay there, maybe do some hunting on the grounds. His fortunes went south. He stopped spending as much time there, but he did return to the property to die in the 1920s. You can tour the bedroom where this happened, but it's not available as one of the suites that can be rented overnight. So then the property was run as a hotel through the 1990s and started to fall apart. The IRS seized it from its owner in the 2000s after he was convicted of running a Ponzi scheme. Federal law says that if the government owns a historic property, it has to do its best to preserve and protect it. And so conservation easements were placed on certain rooms in the mansion.
Wait, there are easements in just a few of the rooms?
Yeah, this is really unusual. I think there's only two or three other properties in Colorado that have something like this. And April Carver said they were one of only three bidders for the property. And she thinks people were pretty much scared away by those easements and working with a historic preservation officer to maintain it. So 10 rooms have to be maintained as they were built at the turn of the 20th century. The game room, for example, is one of these. It even has the original poker and billiards tables. And guests who stay at the castle can actually play cards at that poker table right under this giant original elk head trophy that's a little worse for the wear, but cut him some slack. He's over a century old.
Thanks, Kristen.
Thank you, Zoe.
That's Kristen Kay reporting on the newly restored Redstone Castle.
Thank you.
going to cost more for Colorado residents to hunt, fish, and camp starting January 1st. A license to hunt deer will cost $38 instead of $30, and a fishing license will cost $33, up from $25.
Annual state park passes and nightly campsite fees are also going up. The Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission approved the fee hikes last week after the state legislature approved them in May. The agency uses the revenue to operate its programs and facilities.
Thunder River Theater Company's production of Kimberly Akimbo opens tomorrow evening. It's a dark comedy about a teenage girl whose rare genetic illness causes her body to age faster than it should. Arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay has more.
Director Sue Lavin admits that Kimberly Akimbo might seem like a downer to audiences at first glance. The play tackles mortality and family dysfunction.
And all of that would be something you might feel sad about, except at the center of the play is this very tender-hearted, warm, beautiful character, Kimberly.
Trary Matalone, the actress portraying Kimberly, is a Roaring Fork Valley local with over 20 years of acting experience. Lavin says Matalone's Kimberly is complex but grounded as she faces the challenges that come with her disease. Kimberly Akimbo runs through December 15th. Kristen Kay, Edless Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Released the day after Thanksgiving, the fourth National Climate Assessment makes it clear. Climate change is happening, it's human-caused, and it could make life in the West increasingly difficult. For Aspen Public Radio, Luke Runyon has more.
Climate scientists say with very high confidence that warm temperatures are reducing mountain snowpack, an important water source for tens of millions of Americans. The changing climate is also leading to more intense droughts, increasing the risk of flooding, weakening key infrastructure projects, and depleting groundwater. Without coming up with new ways to manage water and cut greenhouse gas emissions, the report's authors say existing gaps between water supplies and demands in the desert Southwest will only continue to grow. I'm Luke Runyon.
Face of Winter by Warren Miller screens tonight in the Valley. It's the 69th installment of the annual series intended to get viewers excited about the upcoming winter season. Locals might recognize Aspen's Simi Hamilton, a three-time Olympic cross-country skier. He's prominently featured in the film during a segment about the U.S. Olympic team. It's the first time Warren Miller film has featured cross-country skiing since the 80s. This is the first film released since Miller's death in January. The film's conclusion features a tribute to the ski filmmaker. Face of Winter shows at the Wheeler Opera House tonight in Aspen and at the Vaudeville Review in Glenwood Springs. Young people are vaping or smoking e-cigarettes at alarming rates around the country. Colorado youth are vaping nicotine at twice the national average. Wyatt reports on how the Roaring Fork School District is trying to address the problem.
The district is teaming up with Pitkin, Eagle, and Garfield counties to raise awareness about vaping. This spring, prevention specialists will host sessions for parents about vaping. Staff at the school district also will have access to online training that focuses on vaping. The county public health departments plan to put banners on RAFTA buses to raise awareness. A study last year suggested that more than half of high school students in the Roaring Fork schools report to have tried vaping nicotine.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Zoe Rome.
And I'm Wyatt Orme. Tune in Fridays at 3:30 for Valley Roundup, where journalists from around the Valley sit in to talk with host Allison Bechtesh to hash out the headlines and take deep dives into the week's biggest stories.
Snowmass Village is considering raising the age for purchasing nicotine products. Currently, anyone over age 18 can purchase the products, but concerns about teen use have the council considering raising that age to 21. They discussed the change due to parent concerns about vaping or smoking e-cigarettes. That issue came up at a council listening session held earlier this month at the middle school, according to Councilmember Bill Madsen. According to the Centers for Disease Control, consuming nicotine products before age 18 doubles the chance of developing a lifelong smoking habit. Teen cigarette use has dropped, but vaping is surging among teens. Right now, the Colorado Department of Revenue makes sure retailers are compliant with state law and don't sell to underage buyers. If the measure passes, Snowmass would be on the hook to ensure that stores aren't selling to people between 18 and 21. Police Chief Brian Olson says that he supports council's efforts, but likely wouldn't use his officers to enforce the change. The town would lose a projected $15,000 in state kickbacks from cigarette sales due to a provision that bans tobacco regulation in Colorado. Aspen, Basalt, and Carbondale have all raised their minimum age and passed tax increases to make up for the lost revenue. Snowmass Town Council uniformly supports this idea, and Madsen says he expects council would pass an ordinance sometime this winter.
Fire chiefs are praising Governor John Hickenlooper's decision to ask the state Supreme Court to weigh in on a tax policy. Capital Coverage reporter Scott Franz has more.
Fire districts, schools, and other taxing entities think Colorado's Gallagher Amendment and Taxpayer Bill of Rights hurt their budgets. The amendments limit how much money governments can collect from residential property taxes. Hickenlooper is asking the court to decide whether the amendments conflict with each other. Ron Bateman is the chief of Front Range Fire Rescue in Weld County. He says the governor's move could boost the budgets of fire departments by stopping the loss of property tax revenue.
We're frugal, but it takes money to run these businesses, and every bit counts.
But not everyone is happy the governor has gone to the Supreme Court. Critics fear the state is trying to get the power to raise property tax rates without voter approval. I'm Scott Franz.
Eagle County has budgeted money for mental health counselors in its school districts. The commissioners have finalized these contracts, and Wyatt has the details.
The county will give the Roaring Fork School District $80,000 to fund one full-time counselor for 1 year. Results from the Healthy Kids Colorado survey indicate a high need for mental health counselors in school districts across the state. The money in Eagle County comes from the marijuana tax fund. The sales and excise taxes were implemented at the beginning of 2018 and have so far generated over $400,000. Most of that money is going towards this initiative.
Nearly everyone who relies on the Colorado River can agree on one thing. The foundational document that divvies up the water is flawed, but there's no consensus on how to fix it. Luke Runyon has more on whether or not the nearly century-old Colorado River Compact can, or will, ever be renegotiated.
Colorado was considered a swing state in the summer of 2008 when the late John McCain was running for president. Water issues are always top of mind for Western politicians. And that's why when Pueblo Chieftain reporter Charles Ashby got McCain on the phone, he asked him why Colorado voters should trust an Arizonan.
I thought that was relevant because he's downstream on the Colorado River, and Arizona and Nevada and California are big water users.
Because of population growth and dwindling water supplies, Senator McCain said he'd be in favor of renegotiating the Colorado River Compact.
And I knew immediately that was like no. And so I said to him, you sure you want to say that? Because that won't go over well up here.
McCain doubled down. After the interview, Ashby called a few other Colorado politicians to get their reaction. Prominent Democrats and Republicans agreed that McCain was out of line. One Democratic senator went so far as to say we'd be revisiting the compact over his dead body.
Then Governor Bill Ritter said to me after that story ran, he said, Charles, that story may have delivered the state to Obama.
McCain eventually walked back his comments after getting a thorough lashing in the press. With one sentence, he had touched a raw nerve in Western water politics.
A lot of it is just the word choice, renegotiation.
Doug Kenny is a water policy expert at the University of Colorado Boulder. He says the R word tends to inflame old tensions in the watershed between states in the upper basin, like Colorado, and those in the lower basin.
I think a lot of the parties think it's scary simply because it's a little scary to negotiate when not all the parties have the same political power.
Seven U.S. states plus Mexico use the Colorado River, and there's broad consensus that the compact has a math problem. When it was signed in 1922, the agreement projected way more water than actually exists in the river. That created a huge imbalance between supply and demand that continues to today. Kenny says any talk of going back to the drawing board makes smaller states anxious.
You know, if you're in a state like Wyoming and you're sitting down at a negotiation table across from California, you know darn well that California, at any moment, if they wanted to, could just go to Congress and steamroll something through.
While scoffed at a decade ago, today Senator McCain's idea has support among some environmentalists, like Jen Pels with Wild Earth Guardians. The only way to fix the river's fundamental supply-demand problem, she says, is to go back to the beginning.
It's just like curing an illness, right? You have to get at the source.
Pels says the old agreements among the states to manage water in the West are just that. They're old and don't reflect modern realities, like climate change.
I think that is a huge problem, and I think that we don't want to have that conversation because it's hard.
Those problems are clearly on the minds of water managers now, as they negotiate new agreements to boost declining reservoirs and cut back on use in the watershed. Pels says the proposed drought contingency plans don't go far enough.
It's all like shuffling chairs on the Titanic, right? The ship is sinking still. And if you shuffle all those chairs around and you make it look pretty, it's still not going to make any difference. Like, the boat is sinking.
To ever get to a point where the Colorado River Compact was opened back up for renegotiation, you'd need the support of people like Wyoming State Engineer Pat Terrell. And right now, he is not interested.
No. I would never advocate going back to the compact.
Rather than renegotiate the document, he says water managers need to come up with new agreements that build on it and address some of the compact's bad math. But he says don't throw the whole thing out.
We have shown in the Colorado River Basin the ability to adapt, even in areas where the compact may feel constraining.
And it's that word, adaptation, that seems to be going over a lot better with Colorado River water managers than the dreaded R word. I'm Luke Runyon.
The 27th Street Bridge in Glenwood Springs is one of the worst in the state, according to inspectors. It's not dangerous, but it does need a replacement. That project will start at the beginning of 2019. To learn more about the Roaring Fork Valley's latest bridge project, I'm joined by Aspen Public Radio's Wyatt Orm. Hi, Wyatt.
Hi, Zoe.
So what's wrong with the existing bridge? What makes it one of the worst in the state?
There's a lot that's wrong with the 27th Street Bridge. Inspectors rank bridges out of 100, and anything ranked under 80 is considered deficient. The 27th Street Bridge has a rating of 10.5, and that makes it the worst rated bridge in Colorado. I spoke with Jessica Bowser. She's an assistant engineer for Glenwood Springs, and she says that that rating doesn't mean the bridge is dangerous. They would not let people drive on it if it was dangerous, but it needs some new things. It needs a new deck. There's some rusting on the beams, and it's also not quite the right size or the right design to accommodate the amount of traffic that Glenwood Springs is seeing these days.
Okay, so at the beginning of January, crews will start working on a replacement. How is that going to work? Is Glenwood Springs bracing itself for another bridge detour?
No, nothing on the level of the Grand Avenue Bridge. And basically, drivers are going to keep driving on the existing bridge, but crews are going to be building the new bridge next to it. And then Bowser told me sometime this summer, hopefully before the school year starts, they're going to close down the existing bridge for a weekend, demolish it, and then basically slide this new bridge into place.
Is the new bridge just going to be identical to the old one?
No, the construction team is also going to build a separate pedestrian bridge crossing the river. And the current bridge currently has piers that stick down into the river. Those will be taken out. The new bridge will not have piers in the river, so boaters won't need to worry about dodging around those when they float down the Roaring Fork River. They're also going to build a roundabout on the Grand Avenue side of the river to better manage the traffic flow on that side.
How much is this going to cost?
The contract is for almost $10 million. The project got around $1 million from the federal government, about $1 million from the state, $500,000 from Garfield County. But it sounds like right now the city is thinking about bonding out around $7 million. But Jessica Bowser, the engineer I spoke with, said they're still trying to raise money so that they don't put taxpayers on the hook for quite that much. That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Zoe Rome. AspenPublicRadio.org is your one-stop shop for local, national, and world headlines. All of our on-air news stories are archived online, so you never miss a newscast. You can stream or podcast shows like this one and NPR special reports, browse photo slideshows, and find supplemental links to further coverage. Go deeper and go to AspenPublicRadio.org.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.